I'm Laura Harper Lake.
And I'm Sarah Reitzman, and you're listening to Creative Guts.
Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning in to Creative Guts.
Today, we're getting to know Becky Barcy. I know Becky as a former Art Up Front Street artist who now is working at a very cool home studio. Her art is dynamic, colorful, and full of her soul. I love the way she thinks and works, and I can't wait to learn about where her inspiration comes from.
This episode is a little extra special for all of us because Becky also happens to be president of the Creative Guts fan club.
Yeah, she is.
She's our number one listener. Please enjoy this episode with Becky Barcy.
Welcome, Becky, to the Creative Guts podcast.
Hi. I'm so glad to be here.
We're so glad to have you.
No. We're so glad to be here. We're in Becky's studio.
That's right. We are surrounded by your beautiful art. And it brings me back to the Art Up Front Street days when we were both artists at the same artist collective.
It's sad that I'm not there anymore. I miss it terribly, but also glad to have a space closer to home, literally in my home. So I can pop down here and make whenever I get the inspiration.
Yeah. I mean, there's merits to both, like just coming down in the middle of the night or not having to, you know, put on pants. Like,
yeah.
That's awesome. Rose kind of wants us to put on pants. So
that was really the deal breaker. That's really why I left, is I just couldn't work in the nude.
It was the pants thing.
Rose, you got to change those rules.
Anyway,
we're also surrounded by a smorgasbord of snacks. Take note, other guests.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right? Win your way onto the list up at the top if you provide treats.
Becky earned a ton of brownie points.
Oh,
ba-dum-bum.
I can't wait to edit that out.
She served brownies, just in case you guys didn't get that. My mom's a chef, so we always, whenever we had anybody over to the house, we always had something out. So that's why I had to cook. I had to do something.
So that's a very creative thing to be, a chef.
Yes.
So was there creativity growing up all the time in your life?
Yeah. I don't think I ever thought of it in the moment. I was, oh, this is such a creative thing. It just was naturally always there. My mom, when my parents got divorced, my mom went back to college and she went to the Culinary Institute of America, and she was a single mom going to school on her own and working and taking care of us. And she taught me everything I know about cooking, with the exception of Great British Baking Show, because I learned a lot from that, too.
I fall asleep to Great. I like to put it on. But then I'm like, oh, I'm missing the great stuff on there. So yeah. I get to rewatch it a lot.
It's good just background noise. Yeah. And I will re-listen episodes when I'm working actually down here, because it's just so comforting and warm to listen to everybody burning their cakes and things. But it gives me some inspiration. And I try and replicate the desserts whenever I get a chance, or the breads and things like that. I got my sourdough starter going upstairs next to the fireplace.
Oh,
keep it nice and warm. Mm. I have to come up with a name for it, though. It doesn't have a name yet.
For when you go on the show.
That's right.
Yes.
Well, I was like, when they don't have the Great American Baking Show yet, do they? I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But yeah, and thinking about creativity in my family, my mom, of course, is a chef, and she's always coming up with different recipes and inventing things, or going to restaurants and saying, oh, well, they should have done this, and recreating the recipes while we're eating them. But my grandmother is really one of the foundations of creativity in my life. She was a professional artist, and she was a painter, oil pastels primarily, but she was an amazing quilter, and she taught me a lot of stuff early on and just instilled this kind of creative energy in me without me really knowing that it was happening. And so with my cousins and my sister, she would always take us to different museums. And I remember going to, she took us all to Washington, D.C. one year. And so we're going around the Smithsonian's, and it was really important that we went to this place called the Peacock Room. And we called it the Peacock Room. And at, like, 10-year-old me, not having any idea what was in it. And I still don't actually remember what was in the Peacock Room. But I know that's a place at the Smithsonian.
Maybe a lot of turquoise.
Maybe. I don't know. It's time to go back. So, yeah, she was the person who taught me how to draw and just about general proportions of drawing the human face and and things like that. But then she also taught me how to quilt, which was really cool. And I've only made one quilt in my life, but she taught me how to make it just before she passed away. And so it was really great to kind of establish that skill set. And she had made quilts for my sister and all of my cousins, but didn't get around to making me one before she died. But she taught me how to quilt. So I feel like that's probably one of the biggest takeaways.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Nice. Yeah.
So yeah, so that's my grandmother on my dad's side. She was the artist of the Longley family on one part. And then my uncle, my dad's brother, is also a professional artist, and he has a studio in upstate New York, and he works on Cape Cod and Provincetown all summer and has a gallery and a studio there. So we got that.
So you got a long line of colorful family tree.
Very colorful. And then my dad is very talented as well. He's a builder. He's a carpenter. He's a performer. He acts, he sings, he's in Concord Corral. That's right. Concord Corral? Concord Corral. I think it's the Concord, whatever the Concord singing group is, he's in it. You should go listen to him sing. He's got a beautiful tenor voice. Sorry.
I love it.
I know. I'm pretty sure it's Concord Corral, and now Sarah's going to look it up.
I'm going to verify.
Fact-checking in the moment.
No. So he instilled this passion for music in both me and my sister when we were growing up as well, and he would always make us, like, we would go to people's houses and he'd put us on the spot and make us harmonize and,
oh my gosh,
and sing in a round or something. So, there was always this creative energy flying around and having to maybe do a dog and pony show on the spot for any willing participant or a stranger that we came across. Is it, in fact, Concord Corral, Sarah?
Concord Corral.
Ah, yes. I was right.
It feels like with your background and your family, you've had a very interdisciplinary sort of background. Yes, and I see that a lot with your work. You know, there are some artists that kind of just have one discipline and focus. And I'm very similar in that I like to play with everything and work with everything. And I see that in your work. So why don't you tell us about your art?
I have like this crazy smorgasbord of art making that I think I get bored very quickly. I see something or I see a new material and or a color or a pattern or a texture. And I'm like, ooh, I want to do something with that. And I'll do something with it and then I'll see something else. So I have like art ADD and totally self-diagnosed. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I think I'm also an art teacher. And so when I was in school, we had to learn all of these different media and technique. And I just infuse that into whatever I'm making. And so I'll sometimes just do a painting or I'll do a collage and I'll include acrylic and torn paper and pieces of dictionary. And then I'll draw on top of it or I'll add pastel or I don't know. It's just kind of whatever floats my boat in the moment. And also include trash. You're looking over your shoulder at this piece on the corner and like this is it's kind of this self-portrait and it's I can't remember what I titled it, but it's all of these pieces of things that I've collected over many, many years and put in a box. And for whatever reason, that receipt was important to me at some moment in my life and I kept it. And then that little reflector off of a bicycle was also important. So I kept that. And then there's things like the, where is it up there? There's actually a piece. Oh, there it is. A tuna fish wrapper that's held together with a paperclip. And that is actually one of my most prized possessions.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that weird? A tuna fish wrapper with a paperclip because this boy who was maybe a senior when I was a freshman in high school just passed me in the hallway and he's like, here, treasure this. And then I did. I mean, like, what crazy person holds on to a piece of trash for 20 odd years?
I would. I totally would.
So it like is just, there's all these things like keys. I also had a thing for stealing silverware when I was younger. So there's spoons and knives on there, other parts and pieces of trash of my life. But it's all held together on top of pieces of cardboard. So I made this just after we moved to this house because this is hopefully my last time moving, but moving here was my 37th move of my life. And so this concept of transition and upheaval and having to pack and unpack is just so ingrained in my history. And so that is the canvas. The torn cardboard is the canvas for my work and all these other little pieces of my life. I decided, all right, I got to do something with it. They're not going to live in a box for the rest of my life. So if it is so important to me, I'm going to put it on a piece of trash and call it art.
That's really cool. I really hope that tuna fish rapper boy is listening.
I don't even know his name. I don't know. I'll have to find him on Facebook. Like,
send him this episode when it releases and say, you contributed to a piece of art. Did you know that? Right.
Yeah.
That's a timely thing you're saying because I am in the I'm in the process of selling my house.
That's right. Yeah.
And so we packed up half our stuff in anticipation of moving, but we haven't moved yet, so half our stuff is away and gone. Mm-hmm. But in my adult life, I moved around a ton. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the next house is kind of the house we'll be staying in for hopefully a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had no idea how much stuff we actually had until we moved out of our 1.5 like bedroom condo. and it was maybe like a 900 square foot condo. It was tiny. And we had to have a 30 foot truck to come and move everything. I didn't realize how much stuff we accumulate. We have developed a one in, one out policy with a lot of things, which I'm very hard to stick by. I can't do that very well. And so there's a little tricycle in the corner here.
I saw it.
I found that by the side of the road maybe 10 years ago, and I can't get rid of it. I just love it. And I have this dream of rehabbing it and restoring it and giving it to like my future niece or nephew or something like that. But yet it just sits there.
It's working. I've ridden it.
It's really great that it's all metal. It'd be so much easier to rehab than if it was made out of like crappy plastic.
Right. Yeah. No, it's like an authentic tricycle. And some poor soul just threw it away. This has a life to it.
Actually, my dad he always tells a story about his little red tractor. And he loved this tractor and he would ride it all over the yard. He often talks about how many thousands of miles he clocked on his little red tractor. And I don't remember, but somehow it just ended up getting thrown away. And so because he does contracting work, he was in the same town where he grew up. He was doing some work in someone's yard and there was this little tractor, this little red tractor. And it was convinced that it was the exact same one. And it was in someone's garden as like a lawn ornament. And so he had this fantasy of sneaking into their yard and stealing it in the night. But I'm really glad he, he maintained some self-restraint there.
I'm a little upset that he didn't steal
it. I know. Well, my maiden name's Longley, and the Longleys have a really rich history in trespassing. And, some petty theft and things along the way. But I'm really glad it didn't go too far.
Like the silverware behind me.
The silverware, yeah. A couple of candy bars here and there. But I'm not condoning that for any of my students who may be listening.
Cover your ears. I really like that you're making art with pieces that you don't know what to do with, but you want to do something with. I have like 5 or 6 junk boxes that I keep moving because they're junk. To me, they're treasured memories, but I'm not putting much value in them because they're not going on a shelf for me to look at. They're in a box in my basement.
Yeah. So this piece was in the last group show at the Kelly Stelling Gallery, and they wanted me to put a price on it, and I'm like, I don't know. Well, so I just put some random, $500.
You would sell the tuna fish treasure?
Well, I suppose. I mean, I'm an artist, right? Like, will sell. Well, you give me a right price on it. But it got to the point, I actually contacted them like the day before the opening, and I'm like, can I change this to free to a good home? Aww. Because really, that would be the culminating experience for this, is if somebody actually took ownership of it and wanted to give it a final home, because the piece is all about transition and moving and memory and loss and the kind of the shatteredness of having that kind of tumultuous childhood. So to have Free to a Good Home is kind of like a final resting place for the piece. But yeah, nobody wanted it. That's okay. I like it. And it's, you know, it's modular. It comes in all these different pieces. It looks like it's all connected. And actually,
it does.
Actually, I think parts of it are, because I had to do that for the show. But you could.
But you could.
You could literally just tear the whole thing apart. Yeah. Because, and I think that's one of the things that I think is important about art is not being too precious about it. Like, you've got to have some flexibility with what you're making. If you're being so careful with every little thing that you do, then you're just gonna overanalyze and kind of get burned out trying to be such a perfectionist about your work. Like, I came in when I brought that to the gallery, it was literally in a big black plastic bag, and I'm like, here you go, where do you want it?
Which is what Matt Wyatt says is the, you know, what did he say?
That's sort of like the mark measure of a real artist.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. He's all like, right. When people bring stuff in that's super like, oh, this is my baby and my treasure, right. And it's from, you know, 20 years ago, then he's like, okay, like, you were living in the past, but right. When someone brings stuff in, you know, bags, you know, trash bags, and they're like, here, just throw it up.
Yep.
Like, you know, I can be precious with some things, especially breakable things. Yeah. So I think there's a reverse to that. Yeah. But I think it's nice when you can not have it be your whole world.
Right, exactly. And I think that's one of the things that I impress upon my students, too, is like, you may do something to this piece that you absolutely hate, and or you maybe somebody smudges it, or maybe it rubs against somebody else's work and it gets damaged in some way. So how are you going to work with it? How are you going to adapt it and make it your own and work from that happy act and make it into a happy accident? Gotta, you know, reference Bob Ross there.
Of course. So for our listeners' benefit, we're in your studio at home, which is really lovely. And so we're surrounded by all of your art, or a sample of your art. And I'm pretty amazed by just like the range, the diversity of what you're working with. So let's just talk a little bit about, sort of for our listeners' benefit, what your art looks like, how you would describe your own style, and then like all the different mediums that you're working in currently.
All right. So I guess I would describe myself as an interdisciplinary artist. A jack of all trades, master of none kind of thing. Like, I, when I was in college, I'm going to tell you how I got to where I am. Let's start at the beginning. How about that?
Let's do that.
All right. So
that's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Now I'm really got in the zone here. Okay. So I never thought that I was creative. I never thought that I could be an artist. And even though I was surrounded by all these amazingly creative people, and it wasn't until I took like the bare minimum requirement of 3 art classes in high school, but it was I finally took this filmmaking class in high school, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be a filmmaker. Yes. And I got really into cinematography, and especially I was so excited by musical scores, and not that I can read a note of music at all, but just it's the Forrest Gump soundtrack. Oh, it's amazing. And the score for Forrest Gump. So that all that and the just the taking this class and the opportunity to be able to film something and edit it and put it together with music was fascinating to me. So I had made this music video to a Marilyn Manson song. You know, that's what I was into in high school. And I don't even know which one it was. But I submitted that to, I was like, oh, I'm going to be a filmmaker. So I applied to one art school. I applied to the School of Visual Arts and showed them this really horrible music video to a Marilyn Manson soundtrack. And I got in. And I'm like, okay, great. Well, not I guess so I'm going to be, I know, I guess I got something here. And but there are other people in high school that are kind of helping me to find that creative energy. And I had this really awesome art teacher named Miss Carone, who, shout out to Miss Carone, she was amazing. She's still teaching at the high school. But Miss Carone, she let me pretty much do whatever I want in the class. And that really got me excited about going to art school. And I was all set to go. And as a graduation present, my dad took me out to L.A. because he's like, oh, if you're going to be in the film industry, you're going to have to be in L.A. So let's go and check it out. And I hated L.A. It was like the worst. And we sat in traffic for a long time, and it just was not my vibe.
It has a lot of seediness.
Yeah.
And, you know, not like extreme high glamour and then like extreme poverty filthiness.
Well, just cities in general. That's why I live in the woods. Like there's something about cities and just not wanting to touch your shoe that kind of grosses me. I'd much rather like step in a pile of horse poop and then step on a city street sometimes.
And that's our headliner quote.
So we went out to LA, just didn't like it. But that same trip, we went horseback riding in the San Fernando Valley. And we also went horseback riding in the, did that standard Hollywood sign horseback riding track where you're pretty much on like a pony that will not do anything other than walk. But I had been horseback riding my entire life. And I was like, oh, wait. This is what I love. I'm going to be an equine vet. So I, even after putting in our deposit to art school, I switched to an agricultural school. So just before I was supposed to start and move to New York City to go to SVA, I ended up going to SUNY Cobleskill to be a pre-vet student. Except nobody reminded me that I was really bad at math and science. And you really need those things if you want to pursue a career in veterinary medicine. So I have a great degree to shovel horse poop from SUNY Cobleskill. It was a great experience. Loved it. But after 2 years, I realized I wasn't going to get very far, especially because I was failing like biology, those really foundational classes. So I took some time off. I did get an associate's degree in equine science. So, you know, that's something. But then I took a year and a half off to just kind of figure out my life. And during that time, I took classes at the community college. But during the summers, I would work at summer camp that I had been going to since I was in fifth grade, Camp Dakota, just outside of Keene, New Hampshire. I love. All hail Dakota.
Aww.
D-A-K-O-D-A-H, Dakota. So I'm a huge camper nerd. But while I was working there, I would teach in the hobby nook and I would teach art classes. I remember teaching a pinhole camera class. And
oh, cool.
Somehow I learned how to do that. I don't remember how, but I got really into photography. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go and be a photographer. So I finally had some sort of direction in my life now. And my parents at this point are kind of stressing about me just couch hopping from one house to another. But I finally made the decision, all right, I'm going to go and be a photographer. So I applied to SUNY New Paltz and got in, and took a bunch of art classes there. And oddly enough, one of my worst grades in art school was photography. And I do a lot of photography now, but print photography was really a struggle for me. I just could not get my f-stops and my ISO and my shutter speed right.
It's an art in itself, just that part.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So then I started taking art ed classes because I figured I'll never be a photographer at this rate. And I loved art education. I loved it. I loved working with the kids and learning about the theory and starting to take ownership for my education. It took me a long time to realize that I was smart. And I think that's something that a lot of people struggle with. Like they think, oh, I'm not good enough. And especially having those setbacks earlier on where I was like, oh, well, I'm never going to be a vet. Now what? Or, oh, I'm never going to be a photographer. Now what? But I just dove into all things art education. I had this amazing mentor and professor, Dr. Margaret Johnson, and she just was so encouraging, and she really pushed me to pursue research. And I became the president of our National Art Education Association student chapter at our school and took on those leadership roles. And I don't know, I just felt really supported and encouraged, and it just pushed me to want to succeed. And because I was taking all those art education courses, we had to take classes in painting, printmaking, drawing, sculpture, ceramics. And so I was exposed to all these amazing resources. And I ended up concentrating in metals because I have friends who are jewelers, and I loved what they did. So I was like, oh, well, I could be a jeweler. So, all right. So let's count down all the different career paths Becky has wanted to have. Let's see. So it was filmmaker. It was equine vet. It was photographer. It was art education and jeweler.
and there's more time to be something else if you want.
And frankly, I still consider myself invested in all of those, even the equine, not so much the veterinary, but I do still horseback ride and love it. I started to immerse myself in all these different options of creating. And I think that's one of the things that's so beautiful about being an art teacher is that I have that flexibility to play. And every day I teach a different medium or subject, and I'm going to have my students create something different every day. And so I can't just stick with one thing. If I am going to be teaching drawing, painting, printmaking, photography, graphic design, digital art, whatever it is, I have to be making in those mediums myself. And I think that's a really hard for somebody who really classifies themselves as an artist, like mm-hmm. really capital A, I'm an artist, because people will come up to you and say, well, what's your medium? And it's like,
yeah, I'm not, an hour?
I know. Like, where do you start? I am just a creative.
Yeah.
I'm a baker. I love to cook. I love to sing, even though I can't read music. Like,
quilt.
I have made a quilt.
Better than I have made, so. but even looking at your work, I mean, there is this sculptural wovenness with a lot of your stuff. So it kind of transposes between mediums. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big fan of the interdisciplinary artist.
Yeah.
Archetype as well.
Yeah.
Like, that's how I classify myself, because it's just faster to say.
Yeah, exactly. I like to play.
Yes.
And this is my play place. I come down here and it's bursting with color, because we live in such a dark and dreary world. There's so much negativity in our environment. I try to limit my news intake to just, you know, what's the BBC saying first thing in the morning, and that's pretty much what I'll stick to for my news, because I can't be surrounded by all the atrocities and the horror that's happening in our world. And so I try and surround myself with color and energy and positive energy. So that's kind of what manifests in my artwork. Getting to the original question, what am I doing right now? how long has it been? So right now, and there's a couple of pieces, I'm like working on this triptych that's inspired by one of my grad school teachers, George Kramer, who passed away a few months ago. And he had this very playful style of working within, there was a body of work that he did where he painted within the shapes that you see in particle board or in plywood board. Like, so he would identify different pieces within that and color it and put color in it. And there, just his use of color and his play with shapes was something that was always very interesting to me. And so my work is kind of a combination of order and chaos. And I saw a lot of that within his compositions. There's the structure and the order of the plywood, but then this chaos of the textures that are weaving with the wood, and then the color that was layered on top of it. So this triptych is kind of an homage to George Kramer. And I started with just this foundation of washes of different acrylics, and then started layering on top of them with found objects. And I've been working with a square format. There's something very comforting about geometry.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, and just having things be square, but yet the edges are not necessarily perfect. Like, there's torn pages, and that there's textures within each of the objects. And so that creates this balance of order and chaos within those. There's areas that I've masked off so you can reveal the board that the surface that I'm building off of. And it's not done yet. I think I want to do some writing into it. I want to work into it with some ink, some India ink, to add some contrast, but also kind of maybe talk a little bit about my need for order amongst chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You'll notice a lot in some of my more recent pieces, and you see it in this one, the number 10, and whether it's like hash marks of the number 10, or I've actually circled specific numbers. But for me, the number 10 has always, for whatever reason, been powerful to me. When I had a lot of anxiety as a child. And when I was in fourth grade, I have this memory of just walking around the field during recess and counting to the number 10 over and over and over again, just like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then I would go, whoop, and then start again. And I don't know why. It was just a thing that I did. And it may have just been one day, but that stuck in my mind.
Do you still go, huh?
No. But when I'm really, really stressed out, I count things in sets of 10. And so I'll be counting the stairs. Oh, 10 stairs, start again. Or I'll just literally count to 10 in my head over and over and over again. Or I'll draw shapes 10 times. And so there is this repetition that you'll see in a lot of my work of 10. And
that's fascinating. I do see it now. That's kind of like controlling the chaos.
Yeah, I think I might need some psychoanalytical help or something there. Like,
who doesn't? I
know. It's like, why do I do this?
We all do.
Yeah. See, that's kind of a nice, lovely, counting. I will go in and out of the house 3 or 4 times and check the hair dryer or the space heater at work. It's on year round because our office is freezing. And I will walk out to my, the stairwell, and then I'll walk back and I'll do it 3 or 4 times.
Oh, wow.
Almost every day. And I have to say, like, off, off, off. And then, so it's like a minor OCD.
Yeah.
And like when I lock the door, I have to jiggle it 7 times. I just have these, but only when it comes to safety issues.
Oh, interesting. So, like,
I'm worried about burning my house down and my pets, perishing or burning the building that I work in down and being responsible for shutting down an organization.
Right,
get severe anxiety about stuff like that. And I wish I could, I'd
manifest
probably
it by just counting to 10 instead.
I'd save some time.
Yeah.
We all have our things, I guess.
It's time for a short break. Here's a word from our sponsors.
Bonjour, Vinny, my dear friend. You look très sad.
Well, Claude, I've lost my inspiration. An artistic motivation. I need to find a place that could give me joy.
Say no more. In my humble opinion, Art of Front Street Studios and Gallery in Exeter, New Hampshire is the best place to find colorful and divine artwork. Have you heard of it?
No, but I'm all ears. What is this place of wonder you speak of?
It is a collection of 9 artists who have a gallery and studio in the building with a flower mural on it. And you know how I love flowers. You can walk amongst the artist studios, learn what inspires them, and if you're so inclined, purchase a whole variety of work, including paintings, prints, cards, sculptures, fabrications, jewelry, and even more.
I feel happy? Joy? Alive? Just hearing about Art of Front Street has rejuvenated me. Where can I learn more?
Visit www.artoffrontstreet.com or follow them on Facebook or Instagram. They are truly a treasure to behold.
And we're back to the interview. So as a teacher, you're constantly surrounded by creativity of your students, and you're being creative, and you're probably ping-ponging off each other and back and forth. Have your students influenced your creative direction before?
Oh my gosh. I wish I had the creative drive that my kids do sometimes. And they don't know how much that they have. And they're like, they feel like they're flailing around sometimes.
What age range do you teach?
I teach high school.
Oh, awesome. Yes,
so I teach high school art.
You can really get into the conceptual stuff at that point.
Yeah. And I, especially in my advanced studio art class, because that's where there's so much magic that happens. And now I'm squeaking again. Sorry.
Okay. High schoolers, that's terrifying.
No, we have a really great program, and it's a really small school. There's only 400 kids total in the entire, and that's including middle school.
Oh.
So our class sizes are really tiny, and there's this fantastic attention to detail and one-on-one opportunities to really dive deep with the kids.
What school is it?
It's the Derryfield School in Manchester, New Hampshire. Yeah.
Oh, I follow your gallery on Instagram and Facebook.
Yes. Yes.
That's awesome.
Check it out. Come and follow us at Lyceum Gallery. Yeah, check it out. Good. I'm glad you joined. And we'll talk about the gallery in a few minutes, I'm sure. But in terms of being inspired by my students, like every day I'm inspired by them. And it's so exciting to throw ideas back and forth between each other and see how they exchange ideas and build their work through collaboration and critique. It's so exciting. And I think that's one of the things I really miss about Art Up Front Street is the opportunity to be right across from another artist and be like, hey, what do you think about this? Mm-hmm. So that's definitely one of the downsides of having a home studio.
Gosh, you know what we should do? We should have like every few months, like a Becky day, and you just bring your portfolio. Oh,
I love that.
And you know, we'll hang out, and you know, whoever's around.
Yes,
you know, I mean,
yes,
get at least one of us there.
I know, right? So, you know, I'm just gonna go and sit on the stairs, sit on the stoop, and just like, yell if it's closed, it's locked. I'm like, I'll
you
just stand
throw
out
a pebble up at the window upstairs.
Let me in.
Oh, I love it. But that would be nice because that is a huge part of it. I would say, Dawn Amy is probably one of my biggest resources there because we have the same hours.
That's
and
right.
She's got a really good eye.
Yeah.
So I'll be stuck and she'll come in and see that my eyes are completely crossed and be like, you know, you could try this. And it just like, it just sets it.
Deb Wheeler Bean and I have for the last 2 years been like, okay, we're going to do this collaborative project together. And we keep like putting dates on the calendar and not being able to get together, or something happens and we've got to do it.
Yeah.
It's just, there's always going to be an excuse for why you can't make, and you ultimately just have to fight that battle of all right, I'm going to do it. And ultimately having a partner in crime to do it with is the best thing because that gets you going. So I actually did this collaboration with Allison Palazzolo. She lives up in Hopkinton, I believe, but she works at the Hood Museum, and she and I did a collaboration together, and it was fantastic. And we didn't even work physically in the same space together, but we exchanged work, and she altered one of my pieces, and I altered one of hers.
I want to do that.
And
that just sounds like, so rewarding.
And then we were like, okay, we are going to be done by this date, and we did it. And I think that's one of the things you have to do. So if either of you guys want to collaborate, let's set a date and get it done. I will send you home with work today.
I'll do it.
Awesome.
That sounds awesome.
Because then somebody's holding you accountable to it. Mm-hmm. So in to that end, it's so hard sometimes, like I said, to get down here and be making because I teach all day.
Yeah.
And my husband and I both have kind of bizarre and strange hours. So I want to try and spend as much time with him as I can. And so I'm not always in the space, but it's nice to know that it's here.
Mm-hmm.
But I also find, and I was realizing this the other day, cause I was beating myself up. Oh, you're not in the studio enough and you're not making enough, but I'm realizing I am constantly making because I'm always researching something that I can do in my classes, or I'm creating a demo, or I'm taking an online class through Adobe Education Exchange. So I'm constantly building my skill set, and therefore I am creating, I'm making. It's not necessarily something that I'm going to sell, but I'm learning and I'm growing as an artist. But I also bake and I cook every weekend. So that's another form of creative outlet. And so I can't always be beating myself up if I'm not physically in my art studio making quote unquote art. I also have a sketchbook, you know, and I at the very beginning of every single one of my advanced studio art classes, it's actually through the Tiny Book Project of Brooklyn.
I did that.
I think the you're the one who told me about
it.
Yeah. So I have one of the tiny ones. And at the beginning of this school year, I actually had all of my kids make their own little tiny sketchbooks.
Oh, cool.
So for the first 5 minutes of every class, we just spend 5 minutes of quiet time in your tiny sketchbook, and they can do whatever they want. They don't need to share it with anybody. They just have 5 minutes to doodle, to draw, to even write, whatever they want. And I do it with them. So I set kind of a theme for my little sketchbook as flowers, just flowers of the world. And I do just little line drawings of a different type of flower every day.
Oh, I love that so much. So, I love working tiny too.
Yeah.
Like that's really fun.
It's something I'm not as adept at, not something I've practiced as much, but it's fun. And I don't care. Like, it's for me. I'm doing this for me. So what if I care if it's absolutely perfect? And I think that's another thing that holds people up. Oh, my gosh. And that was one of the reasons why I felt like I could never be an artist when I was in high school. And why I think one of the reasons why I didn't pursue as much art earlier on is because I was like, oh, I can't do this. I can barely draw a line straight. So therefore, I can't be an artist.
Which is exactly what this podcast is trying mm-hmm. to combat, mm-hmm. is that perception that you need to be a perfect artist and you need to, you know,
oh, that's just have it out BS. The gate. Yeah, total BS. Like, no, you play. You're expressive. You experiment. You explore. That's what's going to make you an artist.
You know what I saw today? I might cut this out because I might not be able to phrase it right, but I saw like a little... Not a meme, but like a little clipping on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Clipping, because it's 1970.
I don't get that reference.
Oh, a clipping? A clipping? Like a newspaper clipping?
Oh, a newspaper clipping.
So like a clipping, but it's
that
on
old thing.
Facebook. Gone off the rails here.
You mean anyways, a post?
Yeah, there was a post. There was a post on Facebook, but it was like someone had made up a conversation between two people struggling or stressed about not being a perfect writer mm-hmm. slash artist, a mm-hmm. creative, basically. And the other person's like, well, how long have you been writing for? And they're like, 3 years. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, so you're level three. Mm. So when you were 3 years old, mm-hmm. did you have it all figured mm-hmm. out? Because mm-hmm. the person was like 28 or something. Yep. It's like, it's going to take you a long time to get there.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, yeah. You know, and just enjoy the ride and the process of getting there, because you're never going to be finished or like a masterpiece in yourself. Yeah. You just got to keep doing it and hopefully learn a lot.
Mm-hmm. There's another podcast that I listen to called Artistic Accomplice, and it's by Eric Scott, who is one of the Journal Fodder Junkies with Eric Modler. Two huge sources of inspiration. You guys should definitely look them up.
Ooh.
Eric Modler and Eric Scott. So Artistic Accomplices, he was talking about how he had an art show and he had this painting up on the wall, and somebody came up to him and asked him, well, how long did this take you? And he's like, 42 years. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, that's how long it takes yeah. to be an artist. It takes you your entire life. You're like, you don't just start something and say, oh, it took me an hour. No, I mean, physically, maybe it did, but the skills and the experience and just the background that you've had is what is ultimately helping you to create that piece. So that's always a funny question I get. And my students even ask, oh, how long will this take? I'm like, you may not finish it. It may not be incomplete yeah. by the end of this trimester. Yeah, unfortunately, we're stifled by deadlines. And I hate that I have to, you know, quote unquote, grade something, because oh, I hate grading art.
That must be so difficult.
Awful.
Are you grading the effort put into it more than the
absolutely
product, yeah. quote unquote?
Yeah, I have five criteria that that I grade on, and I try to have my students grade themselves, because they need to be holding themselves accountable for what yeah. they've done, and they get the objectives of the assignment. They have my grading criteria, and I have the same criteria for every single assignment. Because we're such a small school, I have the opportunity to meet with them one-on-one to give feedback about their work. And ultimately, I hate giving a letter grade, a number grade, anything, but that's just the matter of what we
yeah.
need to do in a school. Yeah. So that's... Yep. Yeah.
When I was an undergrad, I had a biochem professor whose grading philosophy was, you try, you get an A, you don't try, you get a B. And those mm-hmm. are the only two grades he gave mm-hmm. out. And it was the easiest B I ever got.
Do nothing, you get a B.
Yeah. Yeah. And every year I reassess my grading policy, and I try and tweak it and the approach that I have. And I try and put as much ownership in the students in the way that they evaluate themselves as I can.
I really like the self-reflection element in that, because I feel like that's something I should adopt a little more in my work. You know, sometimes I'm a little art mm-hmm. ADD too, so mm-hmm. I jump from thing to thing. And I'm actually working on a digital painting right now that I've redone 3 or 4 or 5 times now, and I keep sending new versions to my husband mm-hmm. online while he's at work. And we're both supposed to be working. And he's like, why is she different? Wait, this is totally different. I'm like, yeah, I started yeah. over. I, you know, but...
But do you keep a copy of the original?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's digital. So
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I have it all in Procreate.
I just started working in Procreate recently, and I've found that I'm making duplicates, because yes. I was like, oh, wait, I don't want to. I like
it.
That one. And I could make a new layer yeah. or go over it. But no, I'm just going to make a total copy of it. And
yeah.
which is really, really cool.
Probably going to be hopscotching on over to rapid fire questions, I would say.
Oh,
Is there a main question you want to end on, Sarah?
I don't know. I like them.
Wait. Can I plug something?
You really absolutely
quick? Okay. Definitely.
So I want to pop back over to plug the Lyceum Gallery at the Dairy Field School very quickly. So our gallery is an educational gallery space. We have 5 exhibitions that go on a year, and we are just wrapping up the work of Shayna Gates right now, who is a fantastic artist and came in and did a master class with our students and taught them about her drawing technique and her painting approaches and especially her mark making techniques, which is very, very cool. We have an annual exhibition of work from everybody in the community, from Art Institute of New England College. So students, faculty, staff, alumni, anybody who has some relationship to that program can submit work. And this year's theme is local inspiration. So whether it is your hometown or something from New Hampshire, that is our theme. So you can submit anytime. And go to Dairyfield School/Lyceum Gallery for more information.
Very Yay! Cool. That is awesome.
What else? Everyone, go be like me and like the gallery on Facebook. Mm. Do you think it's probably facebook.com/Lyceum Gallery?
I think so. Something like that. And we're on Instagram.
Ooh.
At Lyceum Gallery.
Right. Beautiful. If we're wrong about those handles, well, whatever. We'll figure it out.
We'll put it on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
Blog.
Yeah.
You will, because I don't manage your Facebook page.
It's 2020. If you can't find something on Facebook, I don't know. You're really old.
Just look in the clippings.
I swear to God. Yeah.
Everything's on Google. My brain said clippings. I still am reliving that moment.
It's all right.
Why did I say
clippings? I don't think I've ever referred to clippings as clippings ever. Will you tell us about some of the obstacles that you've faced as an artist, particularly maybe monetizing your art, but sort of other ways too?
Yeah. Monetizing art is probably one of the biggest challenges. And frankly, because I don't make art to sell. And I think that's one of the misconceptions that people have is like they truly believe, oh, I have to be making art so I can sell it. And that's the only way that I'm going to be a successful artist. And that's not what makes for a successful artist. No, I am an artist because I make. And the biggest obstacle is overcoming your ego. I think, like, trying to be something that you're not and trying to get over yourself is probably one of the biggest things, because you'll have these moments of success and you'll be like, oh, I'm on top of the world and I'm the best artist that's ever going to be. And then you're very quickly brought down to earth by something. And I think it's really important to stay humble and to stay grounded and remember why you became an artist. I mean, nobody becomes an artist to be rich.
Like, for the fame and glory and riches.
It's if that's what your goal is, then you are in the wrong career path.
Like, and you probably have to die first, right?
Right, exactly.
People don't get famous until after they're dead.
So I think some of the biggest obstacles is coming across even other people who are creating, who are trying to be something that they're not, and staying humble in those moments. I think it's really, really important. And just staying true to yourself.
Absolutely. It's tough, because I feel like half the time you're struggling to like believe in yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, you can do it. Mm-hmm. Oh, I have such self-doubt. Mm-hmm. And then like you're on top of the world and thinking you're awesome. And it's like, no, humble. You gotta bring yourself back down. And it's completely just an up and down of regulating. Mm-hmm. You know,
you just totally described being an executive director. I wake up and I feel amazing. And then I wake up and I feel like, what am I doing?
I don't know how to do my job.
I don't know how to do this. Yeah. Why did they hire me?
Oh, that imposter syndrome. Oh my God. No, but that's such a real thing.
Yeah.
And I have that not only as an artist, but like in my career as an educator too. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in charge of all of these young minds. And
did
they
hear that, kiddos?
Like, they're giving me this money to do X, Y, and Z, and I've got to prove something. And then I'm second-guessing myself. And that anxiety just weighs on you. And so
do they know that I don't know what I'm doing?
I know. I just fake it till you make it, baby.
Absolutely. That is so true. That really is.
But honestly, that's why I keep on taking these online classes. It's like, because there's always going to be something new to learn, and I shouldn't be just stuck in what I learned 15 years ago in college. Like, I constantly have to be reinventing myself and experimenting and continuing to grow, because that's the only way that I'm going to stay current and hopefully stay up to date with these kids.
So is there one piece of work or series of work that stands out to you as the best representation of you as an artist? I am genuflecting quite a lot as I say it.
I'm just going to say no. There's not
That's
one thing.
Kind of the right answer.
No.
Yeah.
And if you, again, looking around my studio, again, I've got the smorgasbord of art over here. Like, mm-hmm. There's so much variety. There's not one thing. And I think that the fact that there's so much stuff is actually the best indication of who I am, mm-hmm. because my work is always going to be different and evolve, and I can't just stick to one thing.
So I associate you with what you were working on when I first met you. And one of those, so we're just going to highlight that because I want to talk about it.
Okay.
Just a tiny bit.
Yeah.
The gunpowder
pieces. Yes.
Can you talk about that process? Because I wasn't there the day you did the demo at Art Up Front Street, mm-hmm. but I remember hearing about it.
Yes.
And if you'll look to your right there, Sarah, you will see these very abstract, biomorphic, kind of smoky, yet extremely colorful shapes in these two-dimensional art.
Mm-hmm. That's great. You could write my, like, gallery cards when I'm going for it. So I was drawn to working with gunpowder by this artist, and I'm going to butcher his name, Sai Kua Jiang. He's a Chinese artist, and he works on these on an enormous scale with gunpowder and other accelerants and pyrotechnics. And he does two-dimensional work, but he also does these site-specific installation pieces using elements that create fireworks. So it's pretty cool. And I was like, oh, well, I live near Kittery Trading Post. I bet they carry gunpowder and black powder. So here I go, trudging up to Kittery Trading Post. I'm like, with my pigtails or something. And I'm like, hey, can I get some of this? And they're like, well, what kind do you want? Because there's all these different types of grains. And
interesting.
Yeah, there's many, many different styles of black powder and gunpowder. And black powder and is different than gunpowder. And I forget the major differences because I'm not a chemist.
That's
and
science.
Exactly. Yeah. We already established that I'm not a science person. So I started experimenting with blending those together. And the first time it was a little scary. And
you got your eyebrows
just
still?
Little singe. I do not recommend anybody going out and just doing this on a whim like I did. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe come and watch me do it. And then I can show you how to do it. But there's definitely a control to it. But what I found is that I could draw with it, and I can create line with the powder and control it. But at the same time, there is a lack of control, because when you do ignite it, the little grains will kind of start spinning out, and they'll create these really beautiful soft textures singeing the top layer of the paper, and it burns so quickly that it doesn't have time to light on fire. So that's how we end up getting this kind of charcoal-y effect on the paper surface. So the pieces that you're looking at, I actually started by creating these ink blots and just playing with an acrylic wash and different types of acrylic inks and rolling them around the paper. And I just really liked the Pollock-esque style of these blobs, but there's kind of like this, they're not Rorschach, but you do start to see things in them. There's this, I forget what that is, but there's this condition, it's not a condition, but like people start to see faces and animals mm-hmm. in things that are very non-representational and abstract. And so I started building into that, but trying to pull away and add components onto it that are continue to push the abstraction. So I took little pieces of security envelopes. So I love the texture in security envelopes. And I had done a whole series of different drawings and illustrations that collaged security envelopes into the background. So I found little components where I could place a little bit of this texture to add some contrast to the ink. And then I finished the piece by arranging gunpowder in certain areas and igniting it to create these little bursts of texture that come out. So that series is a combination of between 3 to 4 different media of acrylic paint, collage, and gunpowder and or black powder.
We're going to do rapid fire, which you know is rapid, quick.
Yes.
Succinct answers.
I've been trying to prepare my questions.
We were thinking of throwing in a couple wild cards.
Oh, jeez.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
All right.
Do you have any studio habits?
That is not a rapid fire question. I'm sorry. That is totally not.
She's right.
I love getting a cup of tea. Just an English breakfast, Yorkshire tea. Yorkshire tea. Yorkshire Gotta tea. Have my Yorkshire tea. And I like it with milk. And I let it steep for about 4 minutes, nice and dark. Sorry, that's not a rapid fire question. So tea, yes,
that's
tea. All right. Always tea.
That's all right.
Is there a medium that you haven't done yet that you're hankering to try out?
Oh, I really want to spend more time with oils. So I've worked with water-soluble oils, but I really want to work with traditional oils.
They're a lovely pain in the ass. They're lovely.
Get there someday. Oh, and lithography.
What is that?
Lithography?
Well, I know
it's
what
printmaking.
It is.
You should know this. Come on.
I don't. I don't know what I don't know.
That's okay. That's all right. There's so much to
I've
learn
I've heard
in this
of
world.
It, but I don't know the exact like
it
process of it.
It is a printmaking process. And again, I'm not skilled in it, so I hope that I'll describe it, but it's when you would use some sort of wax resist on a ground stone, and you create your work, and then I think you put that into, or it's there's some sort of acid that's gone on top, and it eats away at the top of the stone, and then I really hope I'm right in saying this.
I didn't even remember what exactly
really
it
neat.
Was. So
I just love when I see lithographs. I love it and they're beautiful. So I would love to learn that.
That's awesome. Yeah.
We can Google it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we don't have time. We need to be rapid. I guess I'll move on to the next one while you look. Do you listen to music when making art? And if so, what is your go-to?
Oh, so I'm all into Lizzo right now. I love Lizzo. So she's been on in the background a lot. But every day is different. And
yeah.
I'm really into Dolly Parton as well.
Oh, nice.
Awesome podcast. Dolly Parton's America. Very, very
I've
good.
I've seen that on the like new and noteworthy yes. section.
Excellent. Love Dolly.
Working 9 to 5.
What a way to make a living.
Yep.
So yeah, I listen. I listen to podcasts a lot.
Yeah.
And but I every day I have a different genre of music, and then I just heart whatever I'm listening to on Spotify. Yeah. So then I'll often go to my liked list and I'll just listen to that. And then suddenly there's like Christmas music playing. So there's a real range in there.
That can get dangerous.
Yeah. But everything from Run DMC to Dolly Parton is what I listen to.
Favorite museum or exhibit you've ever visited?
The Mass MoCA right now is probably one of my favorites. I just brought my students there last week, and it's every time I go, I'm just floored. And the James Turrell exhibit is mind-blowing.
Jeff and I are going to go there pretty soon, actually. It's on our list. Yeah.
It's phenomenal, and it's one of the most rare gems in New England for art. It's not a rare gem, but like not enough people go and they need mm-hmm. to go. It's tremendous. And the Saul LeWitt exhibit there that's on for like the next 25 years or something is just fantastic.
What other artist has influenced you the most? I know. It's like, what's your favorite
really
movie?
Really hard. I'm so sorry. I can answer the movie question.
Well, what's your favorite movie?
Well, I have two. My favorite movies are a tie between Forrest Gump and The Great Escape with Steve McQueen. In response to your question, I think of a body of artists. The expressionists are hugely important in my background. But I was drawn to the impressionists. That was my gateway into art. And mm-hmm. what really first got me so excited about color and mark making, that was probably one of the biggest influences that got me in. That was my gateway drug into art. And then I moved into the expressionist movement. They're killing it.
Now you're an addict.
I'm an addict. I'm addicted to those expressionists. Yeah.
What's the most inspiring location you've traveled to?
Also a very hard question. Walking down a street in Amsterdam, walking through a park in London. Everywhere I go, I find inspiration. There's definitely not one place that I can say is the most inspiring.
Beautiful answer.
I love it. Favorite color?
Blue.
Favorite taste?
A cup of tea. Oh my God. Wow, you guys really pull out. Because I had another answer for this when I was listening to the last season on the radio the other day. And I definitely, it wasn't tea, but tea. Yeah, now I say it's tea.
What was your other answer?
I can't remember now. So this is like where your true self comes out, yeah. Is when you're in front of a microphone.
You're mm-hmm. disarmed.
Yeah, no, a really well-made cup of tea. My mom's cup of tea.
Aw. Mm-hmm. Favorite smell?
A mixture of lavender and eucalyptus.
Ooh.
Mm.
Your favorite sound?
Rain on a roof or on leaves. Yeah, hitting the leaves.
Mm-hmm. Favorite texture?
She did it. She did the little hands.
I knew it was coming, so I was just like.
I love the fresh little pine needles. The very first needles that come out on a bush that are, they're so soft and they haven't gotten hard yet. Over the summer, so in the springtime, it's the really delicate, soft needles on a bush.
That sounds very nice. I immediately thought of like the super like sharp pokey ones.
Not those. No. Not those. No, it's the really super soft ones just in or like late May, early June.
If you could go back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
I would tell myself to be more confident and to take more ownership of my education. I just had... At one point in my life, I just didn't think I was smart and I didn't think I could ever be. And I was totally wrong. And so I'd go back and say, hey, you can do math as long as you apply yourself. I couldn't do that now, but yeah, I'd go back and remind myself that I am smart and that I can do it.
I love that. We all need that reminder.
Yeah.
Here's the final question. What was it like being on Creative Guts, the podcast that you listen to every week?
It was phenomenal.
Yay.
I haven't laughed this much in a long time. It's been a lot of fun.
It's really silly, right? Like, yes. There's nothing to be nervous about. We're just a couple of dorks just hanging out.
No, it's fantastic. And I'm so, so proud of you guys and just appreciative of what you've brought to our community through this podcast, because I've learned about all these amazing artists and creatives in our space, in our towns nearby that I had never heard of before. And so for me, it's great to be able to make other connections. And I'm just so glad and thankful that you're bringing this to our world, because we need more of this. So thank you guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm absolutely just selfish. I mean, I get so fueled up, like, after, like, talking to you, I've already got, like, three ideas of things I want to try and do.
Awesome.
And, like, I'm inspired by your space and by you as a person and an artist. And it's like, oh, like, it's just more fuel in the tank, you know?
All right, Laura.
No, let's go! Charge! Let's run home!
Well, thank you, guys. Oh,
thank you.
Thank you. Now you know how it ends.
I do. You ready? I'm so ready.
Okay. So with that,
show us your creative guts.
Yeah! You did a thing.
I did a thing.
Thank you so much again, Becky, for joining us on Creative Guts. It was such a joy to talk with you about your art. Thank you also for hosting us in your beautiful home studio.
And feeding us.
Feeding us very well.
That was an epic interview. Having Becky dig deep like that was just lovely. I'm very honored to be working on a collaborative piece with her now, too, which may be out now at the time of this release. Thank you so much, Becky. You are so awesome, and we are very lucky to have you on the show. I'm honored that you sat down to chat with us, and I can't wait to see what else you do next.
If you want to check out Becky's work, head on over to BeckyBarcy.com, or you can find her on Instagram. Her handle's ArtsyBarcy. And as always, we'll have all these links and more on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/CreativeGutsPodcast. Our Instagram handle is CreativeGutsPodcast, so if you're not already there, go find us.
Yeah. And our website is creativegutspodcast.com. Thanks for listening to Creative Guts. We hope you are inspired to get out there with your own creativity and make something that gives you joy.
And of course, we'll have a new episode for you next Wednesday.
I can't remember what I was just saying.
You loved being an art educator.
Yes.
And learning about that in
Thank
school.
You. Thank you. It's been a long day. Sarah's cracking up over here. I'm so embarrassed. I'm just... And oh, I'm squeaking in the chair. Sorry.
Sure, that's what it was.
Sorry. I would be very blunt about that. I would definitely own it. And I haven't gotten to... Ooh, sorry, it banged it again.
You don't have to confess. Like,
I'm stopping the whole flow when I hit the mic.
We had a whole conversation yeeting. About that.
Yeet. 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 Oh, I heard yeet. That. That was on a podcast. Yes, I did hear the yeet. Yeah. But no, that's... I will have to... Oh, I could share that with the kids. I could say that. And then they'll think I'm cool.
Yes, that is how it works.
That is not how it works. They just laugh at me.
I have another question that doesn't relate to art. And I know we have to get to... But do you like British culture a lot?
Well, my mom's British.
Oh my God.
So my mom's English. I've lived in England twice. So yes, I love British culture.
You mentioned British baking show. Mm-hmm. Sure, that's just one thing. But then you said the BBC. Mm-hmm. And you almost talked in a British accent at one point.
I'm very bad at talking in a British accent. And
but you lived over there.
I knew. And people tease me for my American accent. All right, so my mom's British and has the most beautiful British accent. And I can't emulate it? I cannot. Hello, my name is Sarah Longley. Like, that's what I do with my British accent. It's so humiliating.
I absolutely love talking in a British accent. Wow. I love accents in general, and I try to do it as much as possible. And actually, I do it every Wednesday night at a Pathfinder game. And then I talk in an Irish accent every Sunday at another game for about 6 hours straight.
Wow.
So I jump between those two a lot. And I'm showing off now, I know.
I do. Well, you practice it.
I do.
I just don't practice.